I never returned my voice after that day, really, because it was massive. But the adrenaline and the hope for tomorrow was driving that process.
Hand-roasted politics, no sugar. International politics, just as you like. To the point. Without filter and no extras. And hopefully, well-tempered. And now, please welcome your host for today.
Good morning, everyone in here, out there. My name is Konstantin Grund. Welcome to a new episode of Hand-Roasted Politics. We are coming back to Sudan today, and amongst other issues. And I have the pleasure to talk to Nisreen El Saim. She is from Sudan, obviously, but she has been rewarded with so many fellowships over the last 2 years that she is giving a hard time to follow up. So first question to you, what is your current occupation?
I am currently founding a network for young climate activists who are coming from countries in conflict. We call it YALAB, Youth Alliance for Local Adaptation and Peace. And it have 27 countries as members, and we have mapped over 350 organizations in these 27 countries. So currently I am the CEO of YALAB.
Good luck with that already. Is it fair to say that you literally contributed to the downfall of Omar al-Bashir?
Yes. The first time I actually went in a demonstration against Omar al-Bashir was me as a student at the University of Khartoum. It was specifically 2012, so 6 years even before the revolution. And if I was older, I would have actually went against al-Bashir even before that. But this one, I was a freshman at the university and I was still 17 years old. And there was a massive demonstrations in the university because everything became extremely expensive, especially after the separation of South Sudan. And of course, they built all of our economy on the gas and oil coming from South Sudan. So when the South Sudan separated, the economy had a drastic fall. And of course, the prices of everything went very high, including the food inside of the university. So the students took the streets, and then a year later, we had the uprising of September 2013. And then in 2014, a student was killed inside of the university. So again, we took the street against the regime because he was killed by the regime with a Kalashnikov in the middle of the campus, and it was like noon, so it wasn't even shade away or something behind doors or something like that. And of course, in 2016, there was a massive demonstrations also because there was a plan to sell the land of the university and move the university somewhere else. And of course, it's a heritage site, let alone the memories of the students and everything. And 24 students were expelled for good, and I think 12 of them were suspended for 2 years. And when they, because it was not a procedure, the procedure was wrong, and when they tried to go and find a lawyer, they were arrested from the lawyer office. And of course, another story started from there. Yeah, 2017 was my lucky year because I graduated after many years of struggling with the power inside of university but also outside. And of course, 2018, the revolution started.
By the way, where is Omar al-Bashir now?
I don't know. I also don't care.
Isn't he supposed to be in The Hague? Is an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court against him?
Yes, of course. This is one of the biggest mistakes of the transitional period. The lack of justice system in Sudan and the lack of accountability for criminals allowed more criminals to blossom, let me say. This was one of the key elements that we, at the beginning, were really calling for it. And I think the transitional period government was so easy on the issue because I understand their position. They wanted to fix the internal judicial system and take away all the Bashir loyal judges and stuff like that. but it takes years to really fix a system that was damaged for 30 years, and it was the easiest way just to deliver Omar al-Bashir, not alone, but Harun also, and many other people to the ICC. I think a lot of people, because ICC, you know, they don't have death sentence. So they said, no, don't send him there, let him here, because then he's accused of not only small crimes, he's accused of genocide, of crimes against humanity.
That's in the context of the Darfur war.
Yes, and also South Kordofan and also Nuba Mountain, so not only one place. Well, I'm talking about the internal cases against him. I'm not talking about the ICC case. The ICC is mainly about Darfur. So a lot of people thought that he deserved to die, basically, and it would not be fair enough to go to ICC and then live there. And believe or not, a lot of people are really dreaming of the life of the prisoners of the ICC. So they say, okay, he do all of this, and then he go and live in The Hague in a very respective situation.
You just mentioned the first half of the year in 2019. Can you take us back a little into time? We are approaching the beginning of June. We are all having in mind the so-called sit-in massacre on the 3rd of June in 2019. Can you tell us what happened?
So what happened on that day is very much linked to the war itself. Why? Because the Islamists in Sudan think that Ramadan is the month where they can actually conquer. So a lot of big massacre events happened in Ramadan, unfortunately. Although in Islam, the actual Islam is total opposite. Ramadan is the month where people stick together, where you really feel about the poor, where you really have this spirit of raising above the normal humanity, the normal greedy humanity. But for the Islamists, it's totally the opposite. And this is why the war happened in the last week of Ramadan, and this is also why the massacre happened in the last week of Ramadan. People were preparing for Eid. I was preparing the clothes of the Eid, and I remember we prepared a massive amount of cakes so that we distributed. And of course, the number was huge, so you really need to make a big amount of cake to be able to distribute it in the sit-in. And there was a lot of balloons and a lot of colorful signs saying happy Eid to everyone. And we were preparing the place for the Eid prayer because everyone wanted to do it there. And I remember I went to visit my dad in Omdurman. My house is actually a walking distance from the sit-in. But I went to Omdurman to visit my dad, and that night, for some reason or another, I couldn't sleep. And then suddenly, I had a small snooze, let me say. And I woke up and my phone had like hundreds of thousands of calls because a lot of people thought I was in there. So they were trying to make sure I'm okay. And I was like, what is happening? And they say, oh, the sitting, and I could hear a lot of gunfires, and I had to call everyone I know in the sitting, and I had to call my husband because our house is like literally 200 meters from the sitting area. And he said, yes, the sounds are like incredible, and there's a lot of bullets, and we had to actually host a lot of people in the house and around it. It was 5 years, not 5 hours. I mean, the actual process took 5 hours, but we really felt it was 5 years. And the sounds of screams, you know, it's just you are in a horror movie, but you're not watching the movie. You are inside of the horror movie itself, but it's not a movie. It's not a setup. It's reality, you know. And then we started the process of looking for missed people who we still didn't find, and then the process of finding a lot of dead bodies in the Nile, and the videos came out of people who tried to document what happened, and then we discovered the loss of our dear friends.
Just to understand a little bit better, if we talk about this sit-in, that is some kind of peaceful sit-in next to the army headquarters in Khartoum, right?
Yes. So how the sitting happened itself was a long process. So, because this is not the first revolution for Sudanese people, there was a tradition that the army takes the side of the people and remove the dictatorship, and then a transitional period start. And then before the end of the transitional period, a coup happened, and again we have another dictatorship. But people said this time should be different because there was a lot of processes that happened. Actually, for me, al-Bashir fell exactly on the 25th of December 2018. Why? Because every time it was elite, it was the politicians, people, the activists, people who I know and I work with, it was the only people who demonstrated. And on the 25th of December, it was the first time when I looked right, I didn't know the people around me, and I looked left and I didn't know the people around me, and I looked back and I didn't know the people behind me. So it was the critical mass. Everyone, whether they are politicians, whether they are activists, whether they are just widows, housewives, employees, even civil servants joined the demonstration. So that day was the day when I said, okay, this regime will not last anymore because this is not a decision of elite people who think al-Bashir is bad and his people are bad. This is the people say. Everyone said Bashir must go and this regime must change. And for me, this were actually the fall of the regime happened.
But still, he was in power officially until April, right, when the TMC put him under house arrest.
Yes. And that's why I was saying that there was a process that led to the sitting. We had many demonstrations per side. I think we had almost 3 per week. And 3 per week for 6 months, you can imagine the number. So there was a massive amount of demonstration. I can tell you hundreds of new ways that the Sudanese people came up with to really fight against the Bashir regime. And then it was the high time to really have a different level where the demonstration doesn't start and end, where we really have more of a stronger pressure. And this is where the decide for the sitting happened. And it was actually, so until we reached the headquarter of the army, there was no decision. And in that day, they cut the internet. But I had also one of the fighting mechanisms. We used to use roaming international SIM cards because they cannot block, you know. It was extremely expensive, but extremely worth it. And I had one of these, and I got a communication, a letter says that since the, I think, 3 million arrived to that place that day, and since the number is so big, then we can do a sitting. Because you cannot have sitting dogs. If the number is small, then they will be targeted and everything. We didn't want any sacrifices, you know. But the number was huge, so everyone said, okay, we have a sitting. And then I remember I had a small mic, and I had to tour all around the sitting area saying, guys, the decision is out. We have a sitting until the regime fall. I never retained my voice after that day, really, because it was massive. But the adrenaline and the hope for tomorrow was driving that process.
How many people died that day?
So the reported number, and by reported I mean people who reported that they have people missing or bodies, talks about 600.
So even after the sit-in massacre, dialogue still continued between parts of the activists and the military to find some common ground for the future. Why is that?
Stupidity. Yes, I mean, from a revolutionary side, I would say stability, because at that time, especially on the 30th of June, I think 6 million took the street that day. There was a massive power and a massive anger also in the street. And the politicians, they couldn't really harvest this anger and this number to really have an actual push. I think... Of course, also this is understandable, that because they were worried, because at the end, the military people are the ones who are having guns. So even if we have 6 million, you don't want to lead the country to another massacre. But they should have trusted the street more, you know. They should have said, no, we give you an opportunity and you wasted by doing the massacre. No more opportunities. We don't want any dialogue with you. You go back and we take the power. But operationally, this was very hard.
Let's move forward a little to October 2021. RSF and SAF initiated a military coup. At the same time, there was the UN mission in Sudan, for Sudan, established, who was supposed to provide some assistance in the transition towards democracy. Did the UN come too late and to play?
Not too late, but too wrong. One, when the coup happened, I remember I was in Saudi Arabia for the Green Saudi, the MENA region initiative, and I will come back again to the climate change topic. And Hamdok was supposed to be the head of the delegation from Sudan, and I was talking to the embassy of Sudan in Riyadh, coordinating with them, because I was the only civil society invited. So I wanted to really go with the delegation, because finally I have a delegation that I'm proud to be part of. So I really wanted to associate myself with them. And they said, yes, the prime minister will arrive 8 a.m. And then they walked me through the whole program. And then I woke up 6 a.m. to get dressed, and I find all of the videos and the messages saying that the coup happened. And that day, I never really understood why someone can take their life, you know. I didn't understand the mental state that people, when they take their life, feel in. But that day, I really didn't find a reason to get off the bed again, you know. Everything we worked for the past 8 years, for me at least, but some people for 30 years were fighting a regime, is like this, in 5-3 hours, gone. With the UN, the problem was not in the timing. The problem was in the design. One, I really like Volker Turks as a person, but he didn't really deep inside believe that this is the right time for a political mission. He and some of his colleagues wrote a paper actually saying that this is not my right time to remove Sudan from chapter 7 to chapter 6 and put, instead of UNITAMS, to put a political mission. And then he applied for the job, which I don't really understand. If you think it's not the right time, why did you? So when you don't really deep inside believe in something, it's really hard to push it the right way. Secondly, the UNITAMS was formed from UN officials who were coming from a worst case scenarios, not a best scenario. So every time they call me and other activists for a meeting to design the mission, I met people who are coming from Somalia, who are coming from Syria, who are coming from Yemen, you know, and they all say the same thing. Sudan is doing very fine. And I was like, no, it is doing fine compared to the countries that you're coming from. But I want Sudan to do fine just like Switzerland, for example, or Austria, or Germany, since we are here. This is the fine level that we're talking about. But for them, in their mind, they had a worst-case scenario, and they were comparing Sudan to it. This is why we didn't really move forward with the mission.
The war that we see today, was there a window of opportunity where it was still avoidable?
Yeah, definitely. The formation of the RSF was a political decision. It wasn't a military need. The army founded RSF to protect them from ISIS and to be able to do all the horrible things they wanted to do. They trained the RSF to really be the savage people. I can't even call them people anymore. And they made them hungry for a long time for such an event, when the amount of violence, especially against women, can skyrocket, because they were, you know, it's just having a beast, and then you're keeping this beast hungry for a long time, and then suddenly you open it on civilians. Of course, the beast will eat everything. The war was also a political decision. It wasn't a military need. It was the Islamist side of the army who decided to fuel this war and sparked the first bullet. But lack of trust from both sides in each other. Of course, I'm not talking about the civilian, I'm just talking about RSF and the army. Couldn't stop, because because when the first attack happened on the RSF, if there was trust, then there is a channel of communication, of course, between Hemeti and Burhan, and they could have agreed that this is individual acts, like they say all the time when a violation happened. They say, this is not us, this is the individual act. And then they bring 5-6 people, and then they just do executions for them, you know. This could have happened also. But the war had a bigger political influence, and it had to continue at least for a few days, because they thought they could control it in a few days.
But we are still 2 years into the fighting now. So what happened?
What happened is that they underestimated the support that RSF having from other countries. The alliance and that other countries' support can actually give. They also underestimated the corruption in the army. A lot of soldiers went into a lot of weapon stores and weapon containers. It didn't work because it was bought like hundreds of years or very old already, and the rest of the money was in someone's pocket, you know. I was there when the war happened, and I could see the huge difference between not only the kind of food that post soldiers are eating, but also like the kind of uniforms and the equipment. And the RSF were in a very advanced technologically, but also you can see that the Hemeti and the rest of the RSF leaders really invested in the equipment of the soldiers. Although, of course, experience-wise, they are by far less experienced than the formal army soldiers.
How happy are you that the SAF announced yesterday the liberation, the so-called liberation of the Khartoum state?
It's the worst, which is the army, or the worst, which is RSF. I mean, I can't be happy because the worst is now worse. But I know that the violations of the SAF is definitely less than the violations of the RSF. By far. I cannot even compare. But I also know very well that currently the leaders of SAF, at least, I'm not talking about the people who voluntarily joined, because these people are really defending their homes and their lands and their people. But I know for sure that the army leaders are only defending the people today because it's in their interest, you know. But when it wasn't their interest, they also fought the people. We've seen that all 2018, 2019, and in 2021, and even before in Darfur, and even before in Nuba Mountains, and so on. So I know that the people of Sudan are not really the priority of the army leaders, and seats might change anytime.
Big question now, what should happen actually to stop the fighting?
There is a lot of big questions, and before people really find answers for these big questions, I don't think there is any possible scenario for the war to stop. One, what will happen to the RSF? Where would they go? Two, what will happen to the army leaders? Three, how can we really build a national army? Four, who's going to take the cost of rebuilding Sudan? Who's going to take the responsibility for that? Four and five are mainly about the Islamists. Are we allowing them to come back? Is this a settlement that the Sudanese people will agree on to allow the Islamists to be back? If they are back, how can we take justice for the previous violations, and how can we make sure it's not repeating again? I'm saying this because now, I think what is happening in Syria is really scary for me. To accept a previous Qaeda person and previous ISIS person who was a terrorist wanted by a lot of governments and countries, to accept him as a new leader of Syria is scary, because this might be the scenario also in Sudan somehow. So what is the cost of stability, really? And who's paying this cost is a big question. But also, why we don't really have support to even sit together and imagine different scenarios and then try to make this imagination really come true, you know? There is a lot of support to make peace, but how can we make peace if we don't have answer for the main questions?
A lot of people left Sudan over the last 2 years, people whom you could think that they could play a role actually in a democratic Sudan under civilian leadership. When is the moment coming that they are invited to be back?
If I am considered from these people, I will not go back if the Islamists came back. Even if it's stable, I will not go back because then I will not be able to really do a difference. It will be the same corruption, it will be the same stinky actions by the government. So I'm definitely not going back if the RSF won this war by any means. I think the only invitation that could happen is when the army leader really talk about openly about the mistakes they did and really take steps into stepping away from the political life. And then they would have bigger, even bigger support from people. And to transfer this to a real, real government, civilian government that the people really choose. And last but not least, agree on to take orders from the civilian government, you know? Because this is the main problem. The army and people in uniform don't want to take orders from people who are not in uniform.
How could you make sure that justice is served once the new chapter is opened in Sudan?
The history is full of different processes to make justice. There is a transitional justice. There is the process that happened in South Africa. There is the process that happened in Liberia. There is the process that happened in Rwanda, which I'm not a very big fan of, where they didn't really solve the problem, just covered it. But it's working for them, you know. It's up to the Sudanese people to decide. And for me, if you ask my personal opinion, I really think that at least opening hearing sessions when they admit all the things they did, the horrible things they did, and how they did it, in detailed, and it have to be recorded so Sudanese people can really know the level of the conspiracy of especially the Islamists and the army against the people at some point.
We have to talk about something else still, which is your favorite topic, obviously, climate change. When you see the international media landscape, we talk a lot about Gaza, we talk about Ukraine, we talk about China, we talk about trade. How frustrated are you that your core topic does not seem to be on one of the top priorities of the international diplomacy at the moment?
I mean, even Sudan is not. There is a lot of tension around Sudan, but I can't say that Sudan is one of the top priorities. Even you, when you mentioned Gaza, you mentioned China, you mentioned Trump, but you didn't mention Sudan. So, yeah. But with climate change, of course, it's understandable. Because if people cannot really solve the problems of today, it's new problems. How can they think of solving problems that are caused 30 years ago and still continuing, you know? Also, people tend to, and the media, of course, to report on the flashy news, a flood destroyed one-third of Pakistan. I think maybe the short span of the social media is doing that, but the coverage for climate change have to be different. The coverage for climate change have to talk about the emissions, it have to talk about the adaptation processes in different countries, it have to talk about the catastrophes that are happening, and it have to talk about the bigger emitter, which is basically the big media owners.
Talking about Sudan, what is the nexus between security policy and climate policy?
Of course. So climate change can cause conflict or spark conflict when there is water scarcity, food scarcity, land issues and stuff like that. And we've seen that in many places, including in Darfur itself. But also climate change impacts people who are in conflict because the climate change don't understand and say, oh, these people are already having hard time. I'll give them a break and then come back next year, you know. It was still hit. And we had it in Sudan. I mean, last year we had 8 million IDPs. And last year we had a massive flood. Actually, the area that was flooded is bigger than Germany. And 2 other million had to again flee. So because of the floods, of course, they lost their houses. Entire villages were swept out, actually. people who were hosting people had to flee, and people who were who fled the war had to again flee the flood. And it was catastrophe because we had cholera even before the flood, and the isolation centers of the cholera with all of the medical waste, with all of the patient, everything was flooded also. So you can imagine how huge the big breakthrough of the cholera happened afterwards. Climate change doesn't know borders and doesn't understand politics. It will keep hitting. So not counting climate change in every step is pure stupidity, really.
You have been participating at various occasions in the so-called COP meetings, one fixed conference at the end of the year. Each year, talking about climate change, and these conferences are taking place for 30 years already. Do you really think that this format is the way to go when dealing with the consequences of climate change?
So the problem with COP is not really in the way or in the design of the COP. The problem of the COP is in the lack of political will of the parties participating. UN processes, just like the General Assembly, just like the Security Council, just like the Human Rights Council, and COPs, are 100% entirely built on the will of the countries to make progress. If I come today and I say, me as, for example, Sudan, I don't want this text to move forward, then the text cannot move forward, because in the UN, all decisions are making consensus, you know. If there is no political will to have more finance, then the more finance will not happen. So what what happens in COP and the failure of the COP is not really a failure of the process. It's a failure of the delegates that represents the countries that goes to COP. So for me, the problem of the COP is a domestic problem of the political administrations of the developed countries that are causing climate change, not in the process itself. We would have a totally different results if the delegations came with a goodwill to really solve the problem of climate change, but it's not there.
How do you see the wave of national populism in that regard? I mean, when you say the national governments, they have to listen to the national populations, obviously, where you could say that climate change is not one of the top priorities. So it is not surprising necessarily that the COP outcomes are so little.
Yes. There's three things. With climate change, it's just like COVID. Climate change has no borders. It will not say, oh, this is Europe, I cannot hit them because they are well-educated and they have more money, you know? And this is Africa, poor people, I hate them. It will hit everyone. The difference is that the developed countries have the means to adapt to climate change and to prevent catastrophes from happening. And even if catastrophe happen, they can rebuild and compensate, you know, the damage. But the poor countries don't have that. So when there is climate change hitting them, there is no safety net for them. Governments don't have any money, a lot of poverty, a lot of diseases already before climate change and before climate crisis. A huge dependence on local markets in terms of the providing of food and in terms of providing of medicine and everything. And when this all is lost, then everything is lost. They don't have the power to import avocado across the Atlantic, for example, you know. So this is the difference when it comes to how climate change impacts people. And I think the national governments and the people don't in developed countries don't really yet feel the impact, and maybe not ready even to lose some of the privilege they have.
We are recording this in Germany, and as you know, we have a new government right now in place. If you could have three wishes for the new government here in Germany, what would that be?
My first wish would be not to go backward. Germany made a lot of progress in many topics over the last 4 years. And if you can't make big progress, and at least don't lose the progress already made. Two, migration is needed in Germany. Everyone can see that. Making it hard is not going to stop illegal migration. It will increase the illegal migration. So formulating migration, especially for skilled labor, in the easiest way is the best way that people will take the formal channels. Three, the madness that's happening west of the West Europe should not really be infectious. Aid is still needed, but it should be redesigned to be more sustainable and doesn't create other dependency cycles, you know. But it's still needed, and development cannot happen if there is no peace. No one will invest in a country that is steered by war. Even if there is all of the resources in the planet in one country, if it's not stable, then it have no economical value.
And with this, we come to the end of this interview. Thank you very much, Nisreen. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for listening in, for watching us wherever you are. And I hope to see you soon again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hand Roasted Politics, No Sugar is a Studio Fritz production for the German Friedrich Ebert Stiftung.